27-year-old Susan Taraskowitz had finally gotten the major promotion she'd been working towards. An employee of Northwest Airlines, Sue was the first woman to achieve the title of Equipment Service Crew Chief. Being a woman in a field dominated by men, she had dealt with a great deal of harassment over the years, which were slowly becoming threats. While working the overnight shift from the 12th to 13th of September 1992, Sue went out to pick up lunch for her crew. She never returned. No one would report Sue missing until the morning of the 14th, at almost the same time her body was being discovered. The investigation into Sue's murder soon revealed that, in the months leading up to her death, federal agencies were looking into a massive credit card theft ring operating out of the Northwest terminal she worked in. Was Sue Taraskowitz murdered in a random crime, or perhaps was she killed because someone believed she had blown the whistle on their multi-million dollar scam? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 136, The Murder of Susan Taraskowitz. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the disturbing murder of 27-year-old Sue Taraskowitz. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. The show is also available on MeWe and Minds. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon available at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions directly through the website or email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. When 27-year-old Sue Taraskowitz was murdered, investigators initially believed it was a random crime. However, an investigation into major fraud at her job led some to wonder if she might have been specifically targeted. This is Episode 136, The Murder of Susan Taraskowitz. Monday, September 14th, 1992, was a cool, clear morning in the city of Revere, Massachusetts. Roger Schmidt, manager of the Bravo Automotive Company, was making his way towards work, heading down Route 1A, Lee Burbank Highway. As Schmidt pulled into the parking lot of the body shop, he noted the odd placement of a vehicle. A blue Toyota Tercel was partially blocking the front of the business. At first, it was assumed that the vehicle had been dropped off for service, but there were no records to indicate that anyone would be bringing in a Tercel that day. As Schmidt looked over the vehicle, he noted something extremely bizarre. Beneath the car, in the rear below the trunk, a puddle had begun forming a sticky red liquid which was dripping from out of the trunk. Schmidt, an experienced mechanic, knew there was nothing about that liquid which would suggest it was related to anything with the car, and so he quickly picked up the phone and notified the police. At approximately 7:30 a.m., police arrived on the scene and began looking over the abandoned vehicle. Once Schmidt pointed out the red liquid, police sought to gain entry to the trunk. Upon opening that trunk, police were met with a grisly scene. The trunk itself was soaked in blood, and lying there was the body of a woman who had clearly been subjected to both multiple stab wounds and a severe physical assault, predominantly targeting her head. It was immediately clear that police were at the scene of a homicide. Additional officers were requested to secure the scene while homicide investigators were dispatched. Unbeknownst to the Revere police, not long after the body had been discovered, Marlene and Ronald Taraskowitz were seeking to file a missing persons report for their daughter, 27-year-old Susan, who hadn't been seen since the early morning hours of Sunday the 13th. It wouldn't take long for investigators to connect the missing woman to the vehicle, and following identification, it was confirmed that Susan wasn't missing but in fact had been murdered before being stuffed into the trunk of her own car. Susan Taraskowitz, who went by the name Sue, was born on February 13, 1965 in Everett, Massachusetts. Her family would move to the town of Saugus when she was just 5. Sue was the baby of the family, having 2 older siblings, a brother, Ronald, and a sister, Deborah. Sue was described as a bright woman with a kind and caring nature. In a video released by the Massachusetts State Police, her mother, Marlene, described her daughter saying, quote, "Susan was beautiful, intelligent, friendly, and had a heart of gold. When she was little, she always wanted to help everybody, do things for everybody. She played soccer, and she was an artist." End quote. Sue dreamed of being a cartoonist from an early age and developed an affinity for the Peanuts comic strip created by Charles Schulz. Her favorite character was Snoopy, and throughout her life she would accumulate a lot of Snoopy figures, stuffed animals, and drawings. Sue's dream of being a cartoonist, though, was somewhat halted as she discovered how difficult it was to get into the field. Sue attended Saugus High School, where she continued to display a talent for both art and athletics. Following her graduation in the summer of 1983, Sue would eventually go on to attend Salem State College, North Shore Community College, and ultimately, the Massachusetts College of Arts. According to Marlene, Sue had several different ideas of a career she wished to pursue. At one point, she went out for the fire department, becoming a reserve firefighter in Swampscott. However, for reasons unknown, Sue eventually got it in her head that she wanted to work at the airport. Always the type to put her full effort into any of her pursuits, Sue was determined to work her way up to working on the ramp, which offered such responsibilities as loading and unloading luggage, guiding planes to and from their gates, performing plane service duties, and even de-icing planes. Sue, like everyone else, began at the bottom of the ladder, working jobs such as being a ticket agent and clearing airplane cabins for Northwest Airlines, which would later merge with Delta, at Boston's Logan Airport beginning in 1987. Sue took to the job naturally and seemed to thoroughly enjoy the challenge of the work, but it didn't take long for Sue to realize that the hardest part of her job might not be the work itself, but instead, dealing with her coworkers. Sue was breaking down a lot of boundaries at the time, being a woman coming into a field which was dominated by men, and according to all available information, some of those men did not appreciate having to work beside a woman. Sue would later recount in her diary multiple instances of sexual harassment. Sue's diary wouldn't be discovered until well after her murder, though it documented in great detail much of the harassment she had been subjected to throughout her first year working for Northwest. There were reports of offensive graffiti written about her in the men's room and sexually explicit drawings, sometimes depicting Sue herself, being left in places for her to find, such as in the cargo holds. In at least one instance, it was reported that a male coworker had exposed himself to her. At one point, sometime in 1989, Sue had begun a short-lived relationship with a coworker, Robert Brooks. While the relationship ended quickly, there didn't appear to be any major issues until Sue began dating someone else. According to her diary, at this point, Brooks became very aggressive and lashed out at Sue on multiple occasions. In one instance, Brooks stormed into the break room and picked up Sue's radio, smashing it right in front of her and several coworkers. Sue's then boyfriend approached Brooks and demanded he buy a new radio, and while Brooks agreed, he never actually did. When Sue herself later confronted Brooks, he allegedly told her that he wasn't afraid of her boyfriend and he would have no problem killing him if he got in his face again. In another instance, Joseph Nuzzo got into a physical altercation with 2 employees. Despite being dwarfed by the larger men, Sue got involved in the fight and helped to break it up, getting Nuzzo to back off. However, involving herself in this manner seemed to earn the ire of Nuzzo, who reportedly struck out at Sue, calling her an expletive, which I won't repeat here other than to say that it begins with the letter C. Also included in Sue's diary was the name of Edward Flaherty. According to the Star Tribune, Sue's diary noted an accusation against Flaherty as being one of the people who had been making harassing phone calls to her home. Trying to handle things the proper way, Sue went to her supervisors with her complaints on multiple occasions, but there seemed to be a disinterest in examining them in the least, though many would later argue that this type of atmosphere was protected by higher-ups. Several times after filing complaints, rather than seeing the harassers face discipline, it would be Sue herself who was punished. Sue was given random tasks such as being assigned to work on a truck, which was responsible for cleaning of airplane bathrooms in response to her complaints. Deanna Hess, a vice president for Northwest, later released a statement explaining that in 1989, Sue had filed complaints against two co-workers, those being Brooks and Nuzzo, for, quote, sexually demeaning remarks, end quote, which resulted in both employees being terminated after Sue provided testimony of the harassment. However, after appealing through their union, both men were rehired under what was called a last chance agreement, a sort of probation where any misstep could result in their final termination. Despite this, Sue was focused on her job and was determined not to let anyone stand in her way. She wasn't going to let the harassment push her out, and instead, she became more focused on rising up the ladder, which would certainly come with some difficulty. Sue would eventually target a promotion, looking to become equipment service crew chief, which would have put her in a management position over the service crew itself. At the time Sue went for the job, she was passed over in February of 92, the promotion being given to a male coworker. However, Sue soon discovered that the promotion had violated company rules, as the male employee had put a bid in, and so Sue filed a grievance with the union. An investigation was launched, which would ultimately side with Sue, giving her both the promotion and back pay from the time she had originally applied. This move, though, did not sit well with many of her male coworkers who had already been harassing her. Many of them didn't want to work for a woman, and so the harassment began ramping up. Herbert Holtz, Sue's parents' attorney, later told the North Adams Transcript, quote, "She was particularly singled out, and I think it's because she was the only one trying to pierce this glass ceiling. She became a lightning rod," end quote. Indeed, Sue was officially the first woman working for Northwest Airlines to ever be promoted to that position. Following her promotion, the harassment would slowly turn from sexual to physically threatening. Shortly after stepping into the new position, Sue opened her locker and found an image drawn on the inside. The image depicted a coffin with Sue's name written on the lid. Beyond just graffiti and insulting statements, Sue's car was subject to vandalism on more than one occasion, and the co-workers who had liked her and supported her throughout her time there had also found that their vehicles were being vandalized. At one point, a vandal arrived at the home of Sue's parents with whom she lived and overnight messed up her sister's car. There's also a report of at least one instance where Sue opened her locker only to discover that someone had urinated in it. Someone, or perhaps more than one person, also began calling Sue's home in the middle of the night. Sometimes the person on the line would threaten or insult Sue. Other times, they would just breathe into the phone. While Sue was dealing with threats and harassment, she was seemingly unaware of a large crime being conducted by some of her coworkers. Beginning sometime in 1990 and running through the early part of 1992, a complex and highly lucrative scam operation was being conducted by employees of Northwest Airlines through Logan Airport. The scam was fairly direct. People in town would apply for credit cards and would receive those cards in the mail. Many of those cards would come out of Minnesota, being transported by Northwest Airlines, and at the time would arrive in Boston and eventually be delivered to the people who requested them. However, at some point, the cards themselves started disappearing before they could be delivered. It was later determined that employees of Northwest, including some of the members of Sue's team, were involved in stealing these cards. Essentially, employees would steal bags of cards. They would then activate the cards with fraudulent information before using them in one of several ways. Sometimes they would bring the cards to a local casino, purchasing chips which they would then trade in for cash. Other times they would use some of those chips to gamble. In other circumstances, the cards would be used to make purchases around town. Since the intended recipients of the cards didn't have a solid date by which their cards should arrive, they wouldn't usually be reported as stolen or missing for days after they'd already been used. By then, the people using the cards illegally would have already made off with a large supply of cash. Credit card companies would later report that they had lost approximately $7 million, though law enforcement would state that that estimate was much lower than the amount actually taken. Ultimately, the FBI, Secret Service, and United States Postal Service embarked on a joint investigation into the scam. According to Sue's family and multiple coworkers, she had no knowledge of the scam until she began reading about it in the local newspapers. According to Inside Edition, Sue's mother stated that she and her husband had asked Sue about the scam and whether or not she was in on it. According to them, Sue had no idea the scam was happening and believed the harassment she had been subjected to was related completely to her being a female superior at Northwest. However, court documents would later show that when investigators cracked down on the credit card ring, multiple Northwest employees who were later charged implied that it was their belief that the ring had been broken up due to Sue snitching on them. To date, no evidence has ever been found to support this, and investigators have stated that Sue was not involved in their investigation at all. Sadly, though, the belief amongst some that Sue could have been cooperating with investigators may have been enough for someone, or multiple people, involved in that theft to want her dead. Three of the men involved in the credit ring were, unsurprisingly, three of the men who had been directly involved with harassing Sue. Robert Brooks, Edward Flaherty, and Joseph Nuzzo would be named in indictments. Nuzzo was fired from Northwest in August of 1992, just a month prior to Sue's murder. Around this same time, according to the Boston Globe, Brooks requested a transfer which sent him to Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport just a few weeks prior to the murder. In the weeks leading up to her murder, friends and coworkers noted several changes in Sue's life. She and a coworker she was dating broke up, though multiple sources reported the breakup was amicable and that had been equally decided upon. Beyond that, Sue began attending services at Boston Church of Christ. Reportedly, Sue became very involved with the church and began attending weekly Bible studies. According to the Globe, on Sundays, Sue would complete her overnight shift and then head directly to church services. While Sue was becoming more involved with the church, she also began to express concerns to coworkers that she was worried about her own safety as the harassment was getting worse. In a sworn affidavit later released during the investigation, an unnamed coworker explained, quote, "She felt that there was someone outside of her home during the evenings. Her sister's automobile was vandalized in the family driveway. She told me that she was afraid," end quote. Sue's coworker, Deborah Mazikas, later expressed that Sue had told her she was frightened of something, though Sue never did elaborate on what or perhaps who. Interestingly, Sue did not include these concerns in her diary, but in the time since her murder, several coworkers and friends have come forward to express that in the weeks leading up to her death, Sue had become concerned for her physical well-being and had suggested that someone might be out to harm her. The situation would come to a brutal and violent climax during Sue's overnight shift from Saturday, September 12th into Sunday, September 13th. Sue was scheduled to work from 11 p.m. on the 12th to 7 a.m. on the 13th. Marlene later expressed that on that particular day, Sue seemed to be in an irritable mood. She wasn't sure what the cause was, though she thought it was related to work, as Sue allegedly made a statement that she had to get to work even though she knew they were going to give her a hard time tonight. Sadly, no one knew that this would be the last time Sue's family would ever see her alive. Sue arrived at work on time, and according to all reports, there was nothing out of the ordinary throughout the first hours of her shift. However, everything took a bizarre turn at approximately 1 a.m. Sue volunteered to go on a lunch run to pick up sandwiches for her crew. It wasn't exactly uncommon for people to go to the sandwich shop, which was in nearby Revere. However, details have since emerged that sometime before she left to get the food, Sue received a phone call from an unidentified person. What exactly was said during that conversation can't be known for sure, though many, including Sue's mother, have since speculated that the call may have been directly related to her murder. Marlene told Boston.com that she believed the call was made likely by someone Sue trusted to arrange a meeting and that it was her conviction that Sue had been set up. At approximately 1 a.m., Sue clocked out for lunch, walked across the parking lot to her blue Toyota Tercel, and drove casually out of the airport. She would never return. Curiously, none of her co-workers reported her absence, and in fact, instead, they used her time card to clock her back in from lunch, and then at 7 a.m. used it again to clock her out of work. When questioned about this later, employees claimed that they were covering for her, not wanting her to get into trouble, but many find that suspicious since Sue also didn't arrive for her shift the next day, and still no one found it necessary to report her missing, despite the fact that she had not returned from the lunch break and was definitely not the type of person to no-show her job. Sue was also supposed to attend a baby shower after work where her other coworkers would be present, but again, Sue did not show up, and again, no one called her home, spoke with her family, or expressed any concerns about her whereabouts. Finally, on the morning of Monday, September 14th, Sue's parents began making their way to the Saugus Police Department to file a missing persons report. Unbeknownst to them at the time, Sue's car and body had already been discovered in nearby Revere. According to investigators, they at first thought they were dealing with a random crime, or perhaps a robbery gone wrong. Examination of the scene found that Sue had been both severely beaten and stabbed multiple times, but authorities noted she was fully clothed when found, and there didn't appear to be any signs of a sexual assault. When asked about the case in the days after the discovery, Carmen Fields, a spokesperson for the Suffolk County District Attorney, told the Boston Globe they weren't exactly sure what they were dealing with yet, saying, quote, "We're looking at all possible scenarios that have been touted. It's not narrowed down to a boyfriend or a fellow employee or anything like that," end quote. In terms of the scene and the investigation itself, few details have ever been released by investigators regarding what evidence they may or may not have found. There's never been any confirmed statements about the possibility of fingerprints or DNA, which suggests to some that investigators either did not find any, or they may have something in their possession but have been unable to make a solid link. While not revealed initially, it was later reported that one item may have been missing from Sue's body. Reportedly, Sue always wore a necklace with a medallion and crucifix, but at the time her body was discovered, that necklace was missing. One detail which makes many people consider the possibility that Sue could have been killed by a coworker or former coworker connects to the location at which she was found. Bravo Automotive was located at 281 Lee Burbank Highway. Just over 300 feet to the north is 297 Lee Burbank Highway, which at the time was known as the Esquire Club. Many of Sue's coworkers were known to frequent that location, and some have speculated that Sue might have been lured there by her killer, perhaps through the mysterious phone call she received the night she was killed. A large funeral was held for Sue, and many of her friends, former associates, and close co-workers attended. Several employees of Logan Airport, including Father Bernard McLaughlin, a chaplain, expressed that the community was devastated by the loss and shocked by the brutality of the crime. Sue was ultimately laid to rest in Woodlawn Cemetery in the town of Everett, where she was born. Charles Schultz himself, the creator of Peanuts and Sue's beloved Snoopy, created a specifically designed Snoopy holding a flower, which was engraved on her tombstone. One of the high points of Sue's life had come years earlier when she had met Schultz at the airport and received his autograph. Sue's family, specifically her mother, expressed at the time that while she believed her daughter was in heaven, her fight here was not done, and she would go to the ends of the earth to find her daughter's killer. In a Boston Globe article dated September 17th, 3 days after Sue's body was found, it was reported that several sources had informed reporters that many of the names involved in the credit card ring investigation were also listed in the investigation into Sue's murder. While no one was directly listed as an official suspect, it is interesting to note that the investigations had begun overlapping, and it was considered a possibility that Sue could have been killed by someone involved in the credit scam. Curiously, While investigators were considering these possibilities, Sue's family at the time was apparently not in the loop, as they had been left to assume that the crime had been random. It wouldn't be until well over a year after Sue's murder that her mother would finally build up the courage to begin looking deeper into the case. Around Christmas of 1993, Marlene stepped into Sue's bedroom, a room she had been avoiding ever since the murder. There, she would find Sue's diary, and for the first time she learned the extent of the harassment her daughter had been subjected to. For Marlene, it began becoming clear that someone Sue worked with had likely been involved in her murder. The investigation into the credit ring ultimately concluded with 37 convictions, 10 of whom were baggage handlers. Robert Brooks, named as using one of the stolen cards and acting as a lookout, made a deal with the prosecution, pleading guilty to theft and fraud. While this deal initially would have resulted in no jail time, it was later found that he had lied during the investigation, which would net him perjury charges and an 18-month sentence. We'll get to those lies shortly. Edward Flaherty, who would also plead guilty, admitted that he had been involved with using some of the stolen cards and that he had tried to pay off gambling debts with them. Joseph Nuzzo was ultimately sentenced to 3 years for his involvement in the credit card scam. Documents related to the case have stated that Nuzzo was considered one of the ringleaders and credited with developing the idea in the first place. Interestingly, court documents show that during the time the credit ring suspects were being brought before a grand jury, Brooks became aware that another grand jury had been assembled, this one to examine Sue's murder. It was during testimony before the grand jury in the murder that Brooks would ultimately commit perjury. There's a lot of information about Nuzzo in addition to Brooks on the record. According to the United States versus Brooks, when Nuzzo was fired for harassing Sue following the fight he was in before he was rehired, he blamed Sue for what had happened and, quote, engaged in a campaign of menacing conduct, end quote. Court documents state that Nuzzo had keyed Sue's car, slashed her tires, staked out her home, made anonymous phone calls, and told multiple people that he would get revenge. On August 14th, Nuzzo was subsequently fired from Northwest and apparently made complaints to several people that he believed Sue had been responsible for his indictment, calling her a rat and a snitch. Around this same time, Brooks sought reassignment to Minnesota, which he was granted, in hopes of distancing himself from the credit investigation, but it didn't work. Brooks did go on to cooperate with the investigation, and his testimony is credited with having helped procure a conviction against Nuzzo. However, in 1996, 4 years after Sue's murder, Brooks was charged with perjury for lies he has apparently told the grand jury. Originally, Brooks told investigators that he could not have been involved in Sue's murder because at the time it occurred, he was working at the airport in Minnesota. When asked if he had had any contact with Joseph Nuzzo the weekend of Sue's murder, he argued that he had had no contact with Nuzzo. The prosecution, though, was able to produce documents which proved both of these statements were lies. Time cards from Brooks' job showed that he was not, in fact, working the night Sue was murdered, and in addition, long-distance phone call records showed that Brooks had had several phone calls with Nuzzo during the month of Sue's murder, September of 1992, and in fact, had spoken to Nuzzo via telephone the weekend Sue was killed. Additional records later showed that Brooks had not only spoken to Nuzzo that weekend, but on the day of the murder, as well as on September 18th and 19th, 4 and 5 days after. Brooks tried to argue that he hadn't lied to obstruct the investigation, but prosecutors weren't impressed with that defense. Despite this information, investigators never were able to assemble enough evidence to show that anyone in the credit ring had been involved in Sue's murder. Unable to get much movement in terms of the murder investigation, Sue's parents turned their attention to the airline itself and its failure to properly address and handle the multiple harassment complaints made by their daughter. In March of 1994, a suit was filed against Northwest via the Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination. Multiple employees who had worked with Sue and witnessed the harassment, as well as having been harassed themselves, gave testimony and sworn affidavits showing that the situation had been horribly handled by Northwest. While the airline's union tried to argue that the case had been filed later than the required deadline, the commission disagreed and allowed it to move forward. In May of 1994, Marlene decided to have billboards erected to draw attention to Sue's case. Two billboards were put up along Lee Burbank Highway, one which read, "Please help us find Susan's killer," and another which asked, "Did you see Susan or her car?" In October of 1995, 3 years after Sue was murdered, a settlement was reached between the airline and Sue's family. Ultimately, Northwest paid out a total of $75,000. Sue's parents noted that they would be using some of the money to set up a memorial scholarship fund named after Sue, as well as putting additional funds towards the investigation. In addition to the $75,000, Northwest also had to establish a reward fund for information related to the arrest of Sue's killer, this award being a sum of $250,000. Deborah Mazikas, Sue's friend who had given statements in the investigation into her harassment, had been fired wrongfully and also filed suit against Northwest. Ultimately, she was awarded $200,000. Another employee, Joseph Snow, who had also participated in the harassment lawsuit, was also fired for his involvement and later filed suit against Northwest for wrongful termination. While suits were settled against Northwest, the criminal investigation into Sue's murder seemed to have stalled. Despite their efforts, detectives had been unable to accumulate enough evidence to officially file charges against anyone, let alone to name anyone as direct suspects in the investigation. In a February 1995 article published by the Star Tribune, Assistant U.S. Attorney David Apfel, who had worked on the credit ring case, stated, quote, "We have not uncovered any connection between the fraud scheme and the murder. There was a suggestion early on because somebody thought she was ratting out, but our office was never aware of her and never worked with her," end quote. This, of course, led many to wonder, even if Sue had not been involved in the investigation, could someone have killed her because they mistakenly thought that she was? In 1996, around the same time that Brooks was being charged with perjury, the FBI got involved in the investigation of Sue's murder. According to the Boston Globe, the FBI became involved due to a probe which alleged that Sue may have been murdered to prevent her from providing evidence against the credit ring. Sue's father, Ronald, told the Globe that he had been frustrated early on with the lack of developments in the case and believed that the information was being kept from them. Ronald stated, quote, "I felt the walls being put up between us, and I decided that I wasn't going to get anywhere this way," end quote. It's been 28 years since Susan Taraskowitz was murdered during a lunch run from her job at Logan Airport. Throughout all that time, her family has had to endure the pain and suffering of never knowing why she was taken from them or who may have been responsible. Marlene remains convinced that her daughter's killer was somehow tied to that credit ring, despite law enforcement stating that they can't find evidence to account for that. Over the years, Marlene has sacrificed much to try and find her daughter's killer. Her marriage collapsed after 36 years, much of which she blames on the stress and frustration of the investigation and her need to find justice. In the years since, both Sue's father and brother have passed away, never knowing the truth. Marlene has held a vigil every year since her daughter's murder, usually outside of Logan Airport. She stands alone, solemn, carrying signs which give a great amount of detail about the case. It's her hope that before her time on this earth runs out, she'll get to see justice served. In September of 2012, 20 years after Sue was killed, Marlene, along with officials from the Massachusetts State Police, held a press conference to address the case. Suffolk County District Attorney Dan Conley, when asked specifically about the credit ring connection, replied, quote, "The detectives over the years have looked at whether or not that was connected in some way to Susan's murder, but the evidence has not risen at this point to where we can say with the kind of confidence that we need that we have identified a suspect or suspects," end quote. Marlene made a plea at the press conference, asking anyone with information to come forward. Unfortunately, there do not appear to have been any developments. Over the years, Marlene has gone on to investigate for herself. At one point, she visited a prison inmate who claimed to have information, though it turned out to be a hoax. She has also conducted stakeouts at her daughter's grave on special dates, wondering if one of these days the killer might pay a visit. Over the years, there's been a lot of debate. Some people believe, as Marlene does, that her daughter was killed by someone involved in the credit card ring. Others have considered that, while this is certainly a possibility, there's also the chance that this crime could have been random and not committed by someone who knew Sue. The fact of the matter is, with as little evidence as has ever been disclosed, there seems to be a dramatic lack of information in this brutal, violent, and senseless crime. In 2014, 22 years after Sue was killed, the Massachusetts State Police issued a series of videos related to the murder. In one of these videos, entitled A Plea for Justice, Marlene herself discussed her daughter's life and her hope that new information would be discovered, or perhaps that someone would come forward. I can't say things better than Marlene herself, and so I'll conclude the evidence section here with a clip of Marlene discussing the murder with a message aimed directly at her daughter's killer.
Susan didn't deserve it. For all the people you talk to about Susan, they'll tell you the wonderful things she did. She was a great daughter. She was a wonderful sister to her brother and sister. And we're missing all the wonderful things about her. Her nieces and nephews know things about her that we talk to about all the time, but they don't have her here. Her father just was heartbroken when she was murdered. It took him apart. So please, come forth. It's not too late. It's never late to solve a murder. A murder case is always open. You know who did it. You have any ideas or heard anything, pick up that phone. Call the state police. Tell them what you know. We've been here 22 years. I am a very healthy woman, and I am not going away. You're going to look over your shoulder until the day that I go, but I will get you, and I will get justice for my Susan.
Now more than ever, you really shouldn't put off seeing a doctor when you're not feeling well. And I know that with everything going on, it can be difficult to put your health first. I often find my schedule so jammed that it's difficult for me to make time to see a doctor, and when I finally can, I can't get anything scheduled that isn't a few weeks out. That's why I use PlushCare. They make seeing a doctor so easy, I do it right from home. PlushCare provides virtual doctor appointments through your smartphone or computer. I just pick a time that works for me and book an appointment right online. I don't have to sit on hold forever to make an appointment or leave the house and sit in a crowded waiting room to be exposed to who knows what. With PlushCare, I can be diagnosed, treated, and even have a prescription sent to my pharmacy of choice if needed within minutes. PlushCare accepts most major insurance carriers and is available in all 50 states. And the doctors care. They're here to help by discussing treatment options and providing prescriptions as needed, and they're available anytime I have questions. And if you need a regular checkup or have questions about mental health, PlushCare doctors are available to help. Schedule an appointment today to discuss your treatment options. PlushCare makes everything so easy. I was able to schedule an appointment in just a few minutes, and the staff was attentive, invested, and extremely helpful. I love being able to attend appointments from the comfort of my own home or from my phone if I'm on the move. With PlushCare, there's no hassle, no delay, and I can get help right when I need it. With PlushCare, I don't have to put off seeing a doctor, and neither should you. No more excuses. Make your appointment today. Go to plushcare.com/trace. That's plushcare.com/trace. plushcare.com/trace. Here's the thing about home security companies. Most trap you with high prices, tricky contracts, and lousy customer support. So while there are a lot of options out there, there's only one no-brainer: SimpliSafe. SimpliSafe's got everything you need to protect your home with none of the drawbacks of traditional home security. It's got an arsenal of sensors and cameras to blanket every room, window, and door tailored specifically for your home. Professional monitoring keeps watch day and night, ready to send police, fire, or medical professionals if there's an emergency. You can set it up yourself in under an hour. Just peel and stick the sensors exactly where you need them. No technician required. And there's no contract, no pushy sales guys, no hidden fees, no fine print. And this all starts at just $15 a month. I'm not the only one who thinks SimpliSafe is great. U.S. News & World Report named it the best overall home security of 2020. I'm extremely security conscious, and SimpliSafe is my preferred choice for home security. They make the process easy and inexpensive, and I feel safe and secure. And now you can, too. Head to simplisafe.com/trace and get a free HD camera, an exclusive offer for Trace Evidence listeners. That's simplisafe.com/trace to make sure they know Trace Evidence sent you. The murder of Sue Taraskiewicz is a disturbing and difficult crime to examine, made all the more complicated by crimes peripheral to or possibly linked to the homicide itself. Anyone who examines this case is going to be met with a long string of unanswered questions, a vast wealth of information which, while intriguing, is not enough to make an arrest, and without question, the overwhelming grief and devastation her family has been forced to endure over these past 28 years. A brilliant woman with a big heart and sharp focus was brutally killed, and whoever committed this crime has managed for all these years to get away with it. Multiple agencies have been involved in the investigation: local police, state police, and even the FBI. Despite all their efforts, specific evidence necessary to make an arrest or even to directly name a suspect has always lingered just outside of their reach. While many believed that the conclusion of the credit fraud ring would result in charges against someone in Sue's murder, that never materialized, and while many details were revealed which cast suspicion, there was never enough to move forward. Throughout all of this, Marlene has remained steadfast in her belief that she will live to see the killer charged, and we can only hope that she'll live to see justice. When examining this case, there are essentially two different paths people go down. Was Sue killed in a completely random crime, or could it have been connected to her job, the harassment she endured, and possibly the mistaken belief that she had knowledge of the credit fraud ring? Considering the preponderance of information available in terms of her coworkers, we'll begin at the bottom and examine the possibility that the murder could have been random first. When police initially arrived on the scene, they thought they were dealing with a completely random crime, though the further they investigated, the less it seemed to make sense. However, at the start, the crime never really looked right. There didn't appear to be any signs of robbery or an attempted robbery, and outside of the necklace that Sue was known to wear, there was nothing missing. Now, in many cases, you'd imagine that if someone had killed Sue with the intention of robbery, they'd have taken something. Frankly, I'd be surprised if someone committed this crime and didn't at least try to take the car. You have to remember, you're in the Boston area. The water isn't that far away, and disposing of a body in the ocean is going to cover up this crime for a lot longer than the way it was eventually discovered. Yet here, it almost feels like whoever committed this crime wanted Sue's body to be found. That doesn't necessarily mean that the murder has to be linked to someone she knew, but it is strange. Were this a random crime, the way in which it occurred is debatable. Sue could have gotten out of her car at some point in time and been attacked. She could have been stopped at a light and someone approached her vehicle. Hell, someone could have been on the side of the road feigning car trouble, simply looking for a potential victim. And perhaps Sue, with her big heart and desire to help others, could have fallen into that trap. While in all cases you try to find a motive, we've also seen a lot of unsolved cases for which no motive has ever been determined. It's been said time and again that crimes without a discernible motive are often the most difficult to solve. So, can we rule out the possibility that someone was out there just looking to kill someone and found Sue? Not really, no. In terms of a potential robbery, the absence of anything worth stealing could have connected this potential robber to being angry and killing his victim. How many cases have we examined where someone's been killed for little to no money at all? Just looking back 2 weeks in episode 135, we looked into the murder of Leah Rowlands, robbed at a convenience store and shot for seemingly no reason at all. Unfortunately, terrible crimes like this happen, and sometimes there is no major motive outside of the fact that someone is looking to commit a crime and decides almost on a whim that they're going to kill their victim no matter what happens. Of course, there are details of the crime which I can't help but be confused by. Why did the killer leave the car in a place where they knew it would be found and found quickly? Why not drive the car out of state, get a few hundred miles away, torch it, and hope that by the time the car is located, you're far away? If it was about a robbery, why kill Sue in the first place? She apparently didn't have anything worth taking outside of perhaps her necklace, which I doubt was very valuable. It doesn't appear that any kind of sexual assault could have been the goal, and if it was, the killer for some reason opted not to go that way. Truly, trying to look at this murder without a motive is frustrating to say the least. But we have to take certain things into consideration. Revere, Massachusetts, where her car was found, ranks a 26 on the crime index. 100 is a good score, so Revere hits pretty low. Statistics show that approximately 273 violent crimes and 905 property crimes occur per year. When you examine the area as a whole, specifically looking into the locations around Logan Airport, you find similar statistics. Ultimately, it's not difficult to conclude that this could be a dangerous area. So when you're looking at this case, you've got Sue, 5'7", 120 pounds, and it's undeniable that someone could have seen her as a potential target, especially when she's driving around by herself at 1 in the morning. The fact of the matter is, given the dramatic absence of physical evidence in this case, it's difficult to rule out the possibility that this crime could have been random. What ultimately makes people turn away from that consideration, and rightfully so, is all of the information we have about how Sue was treated at work, the vendettas that were held against her, and in the midst of all that, a major investigation into a credit card scam which was passing the threshold of more than $7 million. If someone were willing to kill for absolutely nothing, then you know someone would be willing to kill for such a large operation, especially if they believe Sue was involved in exposing it. It doesn't take much to examine Sue's early years with Northwest and realize rapidly that she was subjected to some of the most horrifying, disturbing, and upsetting harassment anyone can be subjected to. The sheer fact that Northwest looked the other way, and in many cases, punished Sue for filing complaints, speaks volumes about how screwed up, corrupt, and abusive that working environment was. The sheer fact that she was able to push through all of that and continue pursuing her desire to work in that airport is a testament to her courage, her drive, and her determination. Unfortunately, for some people, no matter how many times you prove your skill and worth, they're never going to accept a changed situation. It seems quite clear that Northwest was rife with misogyny and that the upper-level management at least looked the other way and, at worst, were directly supportive of it. The money they had to pay out to both Sue's family and her co-workers makes that quite clear. Throughout Sue's diary, she documented multiple instances of harassment and threats. She named three people: Robert Brooks, who she had dated for a short time, Joseph Nuzzo, who had been verbally assaulting her, and Edward Flaherty, who ultimately she didn't seem to have any direct evidence against, though she believed he could have been behind some of the harassing phone calls. Court records, though, seem to suggest that the caller was more than likely Nuzzo himself. Either way, it isn't difficult to make connections between any of these men and the murder investigation since they were questioned about both. In terms of Flaherty, he seems to have been quickly dismissed as investigators never presented additional information about his possible involvement, and when it came down to it, it appeared to be Brooks and Nuzzo who they looked at most closely. Brooks had established himself as a major harasser of Sue's. He broke her radio in the break room in front of multiple co-workers and allegedly told Sue that if her boyfriend got in his face about it, he'd have no problem killing him. Brooks was involved in the credit fraud, using some cards illegally and also working as a lookout while the cards were being stolen. During the investigation into the fraud, Brooks was questioned about Sue's murder and lied to investigators. He claimed he was working in Minnesota the night she was killed, and time cards showed that was not true. Brooks claimed he had not spoken to Nuzzo around the time of the murder, while phone records show they spoke both on the day of the murder and then again 4 days and then 5 days after. It seems clear, if you read between the lines, that investigators were zeroing in on Nuzzo. So, you have to ask yourself why Brooks lied about this in the first place. Is it possible he had knowledge of the crime and was trying to distance himself from it, the way he had requested a transfer to Minnesota once the fraud investigation began? Or did he possibly suspect that Nuzzo could have been involved, and so he lied to distance himself from him? Or was Brooks himself involved? The fact of the matter is, we may never know those answers. I do think it's important to note, though, when the investigation was said and done, there were 37 convictions. In many instances, people either pled guilty or provided evidence against others who had been involved. Brooks provided testimony which was credited as helping prosecutors convict Nuzzo. Would he be willing to roll over so easily in relation to fraud, but somehow have the determination to cover up the murder? I find it hard to believe. He doesn't seem to be the type who would be willing to put his neck on the line for Nuzzo. Then again, it's hard to know where people might fall when a murder rap is on the line, especially if they have more knowledge about it than they're sharing. Nuzzo established himself, according to investigators, as the ringleader of both the credit fraud as well as the campaign of terror waged against Sue. Court documents suggest that Nuzzo keyed Sue's car, slashed her tires, stalked her at home, and made threatening phone calls. Nuzzo seemed to have an issue with Sue from early on, allegedly stemming from an incident in which she broke up a fight and he called her an extremely derogatory term, which led to his temporary termination, only for the union to get him reinstated. Strangely enough, it was after that reinstatement that he began the credit card scam. In their prosecution of both Nuzzo and Brooks, investigators noted that Nuzzo had reportedly made multiple statements about his anger towards Sue and his plans to get revenge. He blamed Sue for his termination, and then when he was fired again after being indicted by the grand jury, he apparently began telling people that he believed Sue had blown the whistle on the credit card scam. Now, it became serious for him, feeling that his freedom was at stake, not to mention a multi-million dollar scam. Would that be enough for someone to want to kill Sue? I think it's difficult to deny that. There is, of course, one major problem. According to everyone involved in the investigation and prosecution of the scam, Sue was not only not involved in the case, but she had no knowledge that the scam was even happening. So the question becomes, was Sue killed because someone thought she was involved, or is it possible she was killed because someone put that idea out into the open and others latched onto it? When it comes to Sue's final hours, we have limited details. At that point, Brooks was living in Minnesota, and Nuzzo had been terminated the month prior. Around 1 a.m., Sue decided to make the lunch run to pick up sandwiches in a shop in Revere, not very far from the airport. We know that Sue received a mysterious phone call sometime before she left. There's never been an explanation of whether that call came in before or after she said she was going to grab lunch, but Sue's mother believes the call was placed by someone she knew and trusted, specifically to lure her to the place where her killer would strike. If investigators know the details of that call, they've never publicly released them, but I'd imagine if they know who had placed it, they probably took a good look at that person. Now, I don't know how it works for you, but at jobs I've had in the past, whenever someone agrees to go pick up lunch, you give them money before they go. Whether or not that occurred here, I can't say for certain, but if it did, isn't it even more bizarre that no one complained about it when she didn't return? Also, it's never made any sense to me that Sue went to get lunch, never came back, and yet her coworkers clocked her back in and then out in the morning, reportedly to cover for her. I've never worked at an airport, but at a lot of jobs I've had in the past, if someone didn't return from lunch, you had to report it because you didn't know if that person was quitting or maybe that something bad could have happened to them, whether it was a crime or an accident or something else. Were something to have happened and we failed to report that absence, we could be directly held liable. Strangely, that doesn't happen here, and for whatever reason, people move forward and seemingly pretend nothing occurred. No one calls her home the next day. No one notifies her parents. No one seems interested in being involved at all. I doubt there's ever going to be anything someone can tell me that's going to make me feel like this is acceptable behavior from a friend, coworker, or anyone else. Now, there doesn't appear to be any direct statements from investigators about a time frame during which the crime was committed. We know the auto shop manager in Revere notified police on the morning of the 14th that Sue's car was sitting in his lot and dripping a red liquid. We know Sue was confirmed alive for the last time at 1 a.m. on the 13th. This leaves a window of approximately 30 hours. We know that Sue did not arrive for her next shift on the evening of the 13th like she was supposed to, nor did she attend a baby shower during that day like she had planned. That helps narrow the window even further, suggesting that Sue was likely killed sometime between 1 a.m. and 2 p.m. on the 13th. It seems unlikely that anyone who was working that night could have been involved. There was never a report of anyone leaving early or going missing for a period of time, but then again, we're talking about people who falsely stamped her time card, so whether or not their accounts that night are accurate is up for debate. This would mean that Sue either encountered her killer at random, was followed by her killer, or perhaps it's like Marlene believes, and Sue was set up. It's safe to say that a call from Nuzzo or Brooks was not going to result in her agreeing to meet up by herself, so it would have had to have been someone else, someone she trusted. Who that person could have been, we simply can't know. It doesn't even necessarily have to have been someone she worked with, but most evidence, circumstantial as it may be, seems to point that way. If there's one detail about the murder which makes me most likely believe that the crime was committed by someone she actually knew, someone who had a major vendetta against her, it's the manner in which she was killed. Sue was apparently beaten so severely that in multiple instances her beating was described as being torture by both reporters and investigators. Then there's the stabbing. In both instances, physical assault and stabbing, these are very personal crimes connected to rage. Whoever killed Sue wasn't completely in control. This wasn't an extremely well-executed crime. It was brutal, it was violent, and some might argue it sent a message. Could that have been part of it? To warn anyone who might be looking to rat about the fraud ring that they would face a similar fate? It's debatable, but it's not completely out of left field. Whoever killed Sue went out of their way to make sure she was found, possibly implying some level of guilt. This doesn't sound like a crime that was super well planned out. You'd imagine they'd have to have had some strategy beyond the murder, perhaps a way of disposing of the car or Sue herself, to transform an obvious homicide into a more obscure and questionable missing persons case. I've often wondered if it was possible that the murder wasn't part of the plan at all. Maybe it was about getting Sue somewhere and questioning her, or maybe threatening her about potential involvement with the investigation into the credit scam. As we now know, Sue didn't know anything about it. But if someone were involved and wanted to scare her into keeping her mouth shut, her insistence that she wasn't involved might have led that person to lash out violently, and maybe things went too far. There's one last angle to the coworker theory, which we didn't really explore in the evidence section, but that's because there isn't a whole lot behind it. Ultimately, there have been some suggestions that the ring itself, the fraud ring with the credit cards, could have been connected to the mafia. A scheme that big involving that much money is likely going to catch the attention of mobsters in the area who are going to want their piece of it if they weren't already involved from the beginning. If there's one thing we know for sure about the mafia, they're not going to hesitate to take action to stop someone who they think could be cooperating with investigators. Some have speculated that this could have happened here, and maybe that's why Sue was found the way she was, to send a message. It's an interesting angle, though unlike much of the investigation, there doesn't seem to be anything to really make that link. It would seem strange that of the 37 people convicted in this scam, not one of them mentioned organized crime at any time, and you know attorneys asked. You can't really work with evidence you don't have. You've got to follow what you do. Once you start wandering down the road of speculation too far, you begin to fall into the trap of making the evidence fit the crime, rather than having the crime fit the evidence. If you lay out everything we know about this case, I think there are some details which are beyond denial. Sue went through an absolute hell over the course of 5 years working for Northwest. She was subjected to harassment and threats frequently, and much of this behavior was condoned by the company she worked for. Several people not only participated in sexual harassment, but also threats of physical harm. A major investigation into a massive fraud ring was happening at the same time, and while investigators were closing in on those involved, at least Nuzzo believed it was Sue herself who had blown the whistle. While some believe this is coincidental, others see it as incontrovertible evidence that Sue's killer was someone connected to that fraud. I would really like to know what you think about this. While there are hundreds of questions lingering around this case, there are facts which are absolutely undeniable. What we know beyond the shadow of a doubt is that in the early morning hours of September 13, 1992, someone committed a violent and vicious crime, robbing the world of a brilliant, caring, and talented woman who had not yet begun to reach her peak. Sue was just 27 when she was killed, and already she was shattering boundaries and blazing a new trail. Unfortunately, people who affect major change are often targeted by those who wish to see things stay exactly as they have always been. In the end, a family was robbed of a daughter, a sister, an aunt. A life so full of potential was snuffed out before her loved ones could ever see the height she might have achieved. In Sue's absence, her mother has taken up the case, and after 28 long years, she isn't even considering giving in. Someone knows exactly what happened that night and possesses knowledge which could finally give comfort to a family, take a killer off the streets, and earn them $250,000. Unfortunately, without new information or an outright confession, the murder of Sue Taraskiewicz will remain open, unsolved, and very cold. If you're looking for more information about the murder of Sue Taraskiewicz, there are many news articles available online. I Know the Trail Went Cold did an episode touching on her case, as well as Unsolved Mysteries and Dateline. If you have any information about the murder of Sue Taraskiewicz, please contact the Massachusetts State Police at 617-727-8817. A $250,000 reward remains in place for information leading to an arrest. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or comment in the Facebook group. Did you know that CrimeCon is coming to the United Kingdom and will be in London on June 12th and 13th, 2021? And I'll be there representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. I'm really looking forward to being a part of this amazing event. And if you're considering going, you can use the promo code TRACE21 for 10% off your ticket. That's TRACE21 for 10% off. Visit crimecon.co.uk for more information. Trace Evidence would not be possible without the amazing support of you incredible listeners. So I'd like to take a moment to thank our amazing Patreon producers. Special thanks to Alicia Lorraine, Anne Bertram, Astrid Nyer, Brittany Bivens, Brian Kemmerling, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, D'Earthy, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Jennifer Winkler, Joni Berkowitz, Kevin Bonham, Michael Draves, Nick Mohar Schurz, Pamela Coburn, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Mascaratolo, Travis Skepko, Stephanie Eve, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, and Tracy Woods. You're all amazing and your contributions are greatly appreciated, as are all patrons. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or visit trace-evidence.com for further information. I want to thank you all for taking the time to listen, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.